Good morning. May it please the court. Jesse Driscoll was denied three fundamental constitutional rights. He was denied his right to proceed through trial while competent. He was denied his right to be present for every critical stage of the proceedings, and he was denied his right to testify in his own defense. I'd like to start off by talking about the competency issue. Mr. Driscoll was entitled to both procedural and substantive due process. As to procedural due process, the question is whether the court followed all the proper procedures set out in statute that the legislature has set forth for protecting the rights of mentally ill defendants. If that court has met the procedural due process requirements, then we continue on to substantive due process. And that is the question of whether the defendant was in fact incompetent during his trial. In this case, the court need not determine whether Mr. Driscoll was denied his right to substantive due process because he was denied his right to procedural due process. So we don't even reach the question of substantive due process. Section 552.020 requires that whenever the court has reasonable cause to believe that the defendant lacks mental fitness to proceed, the court must order an evaluation. After the parties have had the evaluations done, if the evaluations are conflicting, the court shall hold a hearing. In this case, the court didn't do any of that. And there was certainly reasonable cause for the court to do so. First of all, we have the report of Dr. Grunberg 3 months before trial stating that Mr. Driscoll was not competent to stand trial. He was not competent without his medication. He needed help regulating his moods and helping him control his behavior and relieve his anxiety. Counsel tried to get Mr. Driscoll medicated, but was unable to do so. Counsel had concerns, even prior to trial, about Mr. Driscoll's competency and advised the court that they may well need to ask for a competency evaluation during the trial. Mr. Driscoll had a long history of mental health problems. From age 11, he had been suffering panic attacks. He was bipolar, he had intermittent explosive disorder, anxiety and panic attacks, a whole panoply of disorders and medications that he was used to taking. He had attempted suicide repeatedly. He had prior incidents in court where he was unable to control his behavior. He'd been on disability, been shot in the head, had neurocognitive dysfunction. And then, on top of this all, he had a breakdown in the courtroom. After that breakdown, counsel asked for an evaluation. According to a bailiff, who would be a neutral witness, bailiff said that Mr. Driscoll was getting pretty agitated in the courtroom. He was getting too ready to stand up saying, "I got to leave." The bailiff approached Driscoll, put his hands on him, and told him to sit down. Driscoll repeated, "I've got to get out of here." The bailiff said, "You need to sit down right now. When the judge clears you to go, we'll go." The bailiff described how Driscoll was getting pretty worked up, and that the bailiff kept telling Driscoll, "Calm down, I'm going to work with you a second. Get you out of here." When the bailiff did get Mr. Driscoll out of the courtroom, Mr. Driscoll walked to the back of the cell and punched the wall. He was almost hyperventilating, red in the face, crying, rubbing his head, kneeling over like his stomach was hurting. He was unresponsive when he was repeatedly told that the attorneys wanted to speak with him. He gritted his teeth and told the bailiff he wanted to be left alone. He vomited, paced his cell, and was still not able to proceed even hours later. In addition, we have a report from Dr. Fusatola. Now, Dr. Fusatola initially stated that Mr. Driscoll was competent to stand trial, but he conditioned that by saying that, you know, I evaluated Mr. Driscoll in the jail, I don't know how he would be at trial. But I know as he sits in the jail, he is competent. But later, after Driscoll had his breakdown in court, Dr. Fusatola issued a supplemental opinion and stated that before, during, and after these panic attacks, Mr. Driscoll would not be competent to stand trial. Because of all these factors, the court should have ordered an evaluation, and following the parties' different evaluations, had a hearing. It was error for the court to simply say, after reading the written opinions, I believe this one instead of that one, because this one's more recent.
He didn't have any additional panic attacks, is that right?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. He did not have a breakdown in court like he had initially, but at the start of penalty phase, counsel advised the court that Mr. Driscoll was incredibly anxious, and he went into court and had to leave. And now, the thing about these panic attacks is we don't know when they start and when they end. And that's part of the reason why an evaluation was so important after that first panic attack. The court tries to, what it says, or opposing counsel says, is to accommodate these panic attacks. But nothing in 552.020 states that the court can bypass the statutory requirements by putting in its own accommodations. If a defendant is mentally ill, you must follow the statutory provisions, and that is getting the evaluations, having a hearing, fleshing the issue out, seeing after a hearing whether it would be possible to do what they did in trial. But without medication to put Mr. Driscoll through this, given the fact that Dr. Grunberg said he's not competent at all, and then Dr. Fusatola's opinion that these attacks would render him incompetent, just violates his right to procedural due process.
If he had not absented himself from the courtroom, I mean, his purpose in doing that was to avoid having a breakdown
The
courtroom.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Which may have worked to his disadvantage in having a mistrial granted. I mean, if he had stayed in the courtroom and had a full panic attack in that time, would that have benefited him?
In sort of a twisted way, Your Honor. I mean, he was trying. There's no guarantee that the court would have granted a mistrial, and then he would have been worse off. The court didn't seem especially sympathetic to him after the first breakdown in court. And so there wouldn't be a guarantee in his mind that that same thing just wouldn't happen again, that the court says, well, nothing really happened, let's move on. But I think, you know, he was bound, if he had not absented himself, he would have had another panic attack. And he was trying to get a fair trial, and so he was trying to do what the court told him to, which was, if you feel a panic attack coming on, let us know, and we'll take a break. The problem is, in penalty phase, his anxiety had grown to such a point that he wasn't better after a brief recess. When he absented himself because he felt the panic attack coming on, the court did recess for a while, but when the court came back to Mr. Driscoll, Mr. Driscoll still wasn't ready to go. And the court said, we've got to go. We're going with you or without you. And so he missed the testimony of the state's witnesses in penalty phase.
Are there any cases similar to this where an anxiety disorder like this has been held to render a defendant not competent to stand trial?
I looked for cases specifically about anxiety. I couldn't find any in particular. I did find one, State versus Coco, which I felt was analogous, that I talked about in my brief, that dealt with a defendant who would have seizures. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the court took a lot of precautions to make sure that the court knew exactly how to deal with the seizures and what was needed so that the defendant would receive a fair trial. None of that happened here. The court, instead of following the statutory requirements, tried to do these accommodations instead of dealing with the issue, which was that the defendant was not medicated and he would continue to have, from what Grunberg said, he would continue to have this problem throughout the trial. Instead of stopping the proceedings, getting him medicated, they forced him to have these attacks or to absent himself from the courtroom.
How much of your argument is dependent on our agreeing with you that you can't, in a capital case, you can't waive your right to be present during the trial?
Your Honor, I don't think we even need to get there, because he was denied procedural due process, just as in Pate versus Robinson or State versus Tilden or the Drope case. He was denied procedural due process, and that's the end of the question. He gets sent back for evaluations and hearing, and if he's able to stand trial, a new trial. You know, I raised the issue about whether he can waive his right to trial, to presence in a capital trial, because it appears that this court does not follow what is currently still the standard at the Supreme Court. But I recognize that the court, for quite a while, has held that defendants can waive the right to be present. So I don't think that my argument hinges entirely on that. I think that's sort of a preliminary thing, but then I go on to explain why his waiver was not voluntary. It was conditional, and it was just because he felt that he could not be present without having these panic attacks. The same with the right to testify. The fact that he feared having these panic attacks affected so much of the trial. Being present, testifying, and that's something that I believe the court talks about in the Drope case, that competence really touches on so many aspects of the trial, because it affects whether the defendant is present and can testify and help counsel and all that sort of thing. I'm sorry, I'm looking through my notes to see what else I can cover with you. I want to make sure that the court understands. I know that the time frame was somewhat confusing because there's a lot going on, but in penalty phase, Driscoll really missed a lot. He missed the testimony of all the state's witnesses. He missed the testimony of four of the defense witnesses, and he was largely in and out throughout the rest of the proceedings. I think when I counted him up, in penalty phase, he had to leave six times, and some of those were for lengthy periods of time. There's another issue I'd like to talk to you about, and that is the exhibits. The defense counsels had presented the testimony of two expert witnesses, Dr. Hanlon and Dr. Brene. Hanlon was a clinical neuropsychologist who talked about Driscoll's cognitive functioning, and Brené was a forensic psychiatrist who talked about the role of genetics. Defense counsel, through these witnesses, had admitted about six or seven exhibits, which the experts had used in coming to their conclusions. And during the cross-examination of these witnesses, the state really hammered on them that they were making a lot of money, that basically the theme was these are paid hacks, they have no basis for their opinions, et cetera, et cetera. And those themes carried over into closing argument. The state really hammered on these defense experts. In deliberations, the jurors asked for all the exhibits. The court told counsel either all of the exhibits go or none of the exhibits go. But because the parties could not agree, the court said, okay, none of the exhibits would go. In a death case, it's especially important to let the jurors see all the evidence. The jury's entitled to any evidence that is helpful. And due process demands that the defense have a chance to rebut the state's evidence. This court held in Taylor and in Hutchinson that counsel were ineffective for not getting exhibits submitted to the court, admitted into evidence, regarding the defendant's troubled background, history of psychiatric problems, etc. So the question is, how can it be wrong for defense counsel not to offer records, but okay for the court to keep them from the jury?
Has any case ever reversed on the basis of failing to give exhibits that have been requested by the jury to the jury?
I do not know of any off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I believe that this is a good case for it.
What exhibits did the defense not want the state to send back?
The defense, what had happened was initially the state had agreed that it would read into evidence the prior convictions of the defendant. So the jury would know what the crime was, where it happened, what the sentence was, etc. Basic facts about the case. It was not going to publish those exhibits to the jury. That was the agreement. And that's what happened. Then up until the time when the jurors asked for all the exhibits, things changed. And then the state wanted those exhibits to go to the jurors. Defense counsel had a problem with that because those exhibits had redactions that made it seem that Driscoll had been charged with other crimes that perhaps had been dropped as a result of plea negotiations or whatever. And so at trial, he had never gotten a chance to bring out, he's basically being faced in deliberations with evidence that he never had the chance to counter during the course of the trial, and that's part of the problem.
Were those the only exhibits that the defendant wouldn't agree to go back?
That the defense what?
Were those the only exhibits that defense counsel did not want to go back to the jury?
That was pretty much the state's evidence in the only exhibits that the state had in penalty phase, from what I recall, were those exhibits. In penalty phase, the bulk of the exhibits were defense exhibits. And ironically, earlier in trial, in guilt phase, where many of the exhibits were state's exhibits, the court said, okay, everything goes back to the jury. Now, nothing goes back to the jury when there's defense exhibits that would really help the defense.
What was it the jury actually asked for?
All exhibits.
All exhibits?
Yes. They want to see all the exhibits, penalty phase exhibits.
Did they ask for the state's evidence to them, the state's exhibits also?
Yeah, they just said all the exhibits. Okay. So, if there's no further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you. You'll have time on rebuttal.
May it please the court, Sean McElprank for the state of Missouri. If I may touch briefly on the last point that was discussed, the exhibits. The court received a request from the jury for all the exhibits and interpreted that as a request for all the exhibits that had been submitted by both sides.
Counsel, in your brief, you say that they asked for all the evidence/submissions during the penalty phase.
Right.
Is that
that is what I think that the text of their handwritten note to the jury was.
So it's your interpretation that they meant exhibits.
Well, that was at least I think that was the trial court's interpretation, and I think it's probably a reasonable interpretation. Although there, you know, it could be that the jurors were also asking for transcripts of testimony. I've seen specific requests along those lines where we'd like to see all the evidence, including transcripts. And of course, in those kinds of cases, the court normally responds that transcripts aren't available, or the jury has to, consider the evidence as it remembers it, or something along those lines. In this case, the trial court interpreted it as a request for all of the exhibits, and I think based on the inclusion of the word submissions, that was a reasonable interpretation. But the Mr. Driscoll asserts that there was an agreement about how the state's exhibits would be handled, and actually, I'm not sure that the record reflects any discussions about a particular agreement, although when it came time to present the state's evidence, the state did read in, but then also admitted into evidence the actual exhibit. So, and there wasn't any objection at that point, as far as I recall, to the admission of those exhibits into evidence. Now, they were not published at that time to the jury. They were not passed out and handed around to the jury at that time. But I don't recall it in the record anything about any agreement that if the jurors requested all the exhibits that the state would not send them back. And of course, when the request came in, whatever discussions may have occurred before that, which are not apparent on the record, the state wanted its exhibits to go back, just like the defense wanted their exhibits to go back, and ultimately the parties couldn't agree because the defense objected to the state's exhibits going back to the jury. And I guess lodged an alternative request that maybe just a list of the names of the offenses be typed up and submitted.
Why wouldn't that have been adequate?
Well, I don't know that it would have. I think the trial court might have been able to exercise discretion and say, well, let's go ahead and do that. But I don't think that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to say, that's not really the evidence. That's not really the exhibit that was admitted into evidence. So I think it's better to, perhaps send back the redacted exhibits. I mean, there's a lot of information.
Is it effective? Was there a specific agreement that the jury would not see that exhibit, though, and there was not that agreement as to the others?
I don't think, I didn't find anything in the record showing a specific agreement that the jurors would never see the exhibit. Now, the record reflects that those exhibits were not published to the jury at the time they were admitted into evidence. I think that's clear from the record.
What about the defense exhibits? Were they published to the jury?
I don't think they were specifically published to the jury either. The experts testified about them, offered testimony, highlighted salient aspects of those exhibits, and thereby sort of supplemented their testimony. And I think that that's, when you get right down to it, the defendant makes various arguments about how the trial court deprived him of his right to present a defense or to present all relevant mitigating evidence, those sorts of things. But that didn't occur in this case. It was all presented to the jury. It was all admitted into evidence. And the salient aspects of those exhibits were highlighted by the experts. And to the extent that there was mitigation evidence to be gleaned from those, I think it's reasonable to assume that defense pointed their experts to those parts of the exhibits and said, this is what I think is important, and elicited that testimony from the experts. There isn't there was no limitation placed upon the defense attorneys as they were questioning the experts in terms of, you can't talk about that, or you can't ask them questions about those exhibits. Those exhibits were admitted, presented, relied upon, testified about, and presented to the jury through the lens of the expert's testimony in a manner that I think was probably more accessible to the jury than had the exhibits just been given to them so they could leaf through them themselves. So the trial court's ruling didn't actually deprive the defendant of his opportunity to put on mitigating evidence or to present a defense or anything of the sort. Really, it just came down to a fairness call by the trial court, which was, if you want your exhibits to go back, then you're going to have to let the state's exhibits go back. Similar to what occurred in, I believe it's the Barnett case, which I cited in my brief, where the trial court determined that as a matter of fairness, it wasn't going to send back just one side's exhibits. Moving to the other point, in terms of the defendant's competence to stand trial. You know, the defendant's argument is essentially that that he was not competent to stand trial, and the trial court didn't follow proper procedures to determine whether he was competent. But the trial court never really received any evidence suggesting that the defendant was not competent to stand trial, at least in the manner that is that became important in this case. It's important to remember in this case, the defendant, he had a history of suffering from anxiety, had a history of suffering from intermittent explosive disorder. But none of the experts who evaluated Mr. Driscoll ever said, this is a man who doesn't have the cognitive ability to rationally understand the proceedings.
But they did say he needed medication. Why did he not get medication?
Let me address that in two parts. First of all, I think that the one expert who suggested that he needed medication, Dr. Gruenberg, she actually said that he should be evaluated to see whether he should be able to continue with medication. She didn't actually, and I apologize.
Well, she wasn't sure what medication would do, but
that's
right. He needed something to control these panic attacks. What was the state's objection or the corrections department's objection to the medication?
Well, actually, I don't think the defense actually requested medication at any time. What they requested was a further competency evaluation. And whether the trial court had the authority...
I thought in the briefs it said that they had requested it and there was some outside expert who said he wasn't allowed to have medication.
No, what defense counsel said was she had asked Department of Corrections
right.
to give the defendant some medication.
Yes.
But there wasn't any request on the part of, for example, the counsel to say, hey, we need you to order him to get some medication.
What does the record show as to why the Department of Corrections did not allow defendant to take medication
Nothing.
After that exam?
Nothing but for counsel's assertion that they wouldn't give it on the advice of outside doctor. Now, there was no evidence, for example, that he wasn't receiving medical care in Department of Corrections and that he wasn't receiving mental health treatment in Department of Corrections.
Is this just a blank in the record on these facts?
Essentially, yes. And, you know, to the extent that there was some indication in Dr. Gruenberg's report that medication might be helpful, the question, I think, that ultimately arises is, Did the reports that were submitted to the trial court raise a reasonable question as to the defendant's competence to stand trial? Now, both doctors said that he had a rational and factual understanding of the case. He had a rational understanding of the proceedings. He knew what was going on.
There was a lot beyond the reports that the trial court observed, and isn't that also part of the trial court's obligation to observe the demeanor?
Yes, and I'm sorry.
And the trial court responded dramatically to the trial court's observations of that demeanor.
That's correct.
And so isn't that something significant that would cause us to believe the trial court observed behavior that precluded trial from being held normally?
Well, I think it did preclude trial from being held normally, and this trial didn't proceed in the normal fashion. And I apologize, Your Honor, I missed the very first part of your question.
In determining competence, it's not just the doctor's reports, it is
right.
the counsel's observation and the court's observations that are to be considered as to reasonableness to determine competence.
That is correct, Your Honor. And here, the defense counsel reported a concern that he might not be competent during a panic attack or something along those lines. Dr. Gruenberg's report amounts to the same thing. She indicated that Mr. Driscoll was generally competent in terms of his factual understanding, his rational understanding. He was not a person who, for example, had a very low IQ. He was average. His rational understanding of the world was fine. He was oriented to person, place, time, those sorts of things. But Dr. Grunberg indicated, and I apologize, Your Honor, you're about to ask a question.
Well, I was just going to say, I think both sides agree that it's during the panic attacks that he's not competent, but I'm sure you understand that opposing counsel's argument is that if he had a panic attack in front of the jury, that would prejudice the jury, so he left to avoid that, and because he wasn't given medication or given other treatment which would control the attacks, and so it wasn't really voluntary that he left, and it wasn't, it precluded him from taking part normally in the trial, and that in itself prejudiced the jury.
Well, I think that there's two parts to answer that. One is that whenever he felt something coming on, apparently he would tell counsel, and counsel would make a request. Now, during the first day of trial, or excuse me, the guilt phase of trial, there were essentially no issues throughout the trial. I mean, there was voir dire, but I meant during the presentation of evidence, during the presentation of the case. There were essentially no issues throughout the case where there was any sort of panic attack. Now, the defendant at times did request a break or a recess, and I think the record shows that the trial court was very accommodating to these requests and recessed and then continued the case, continued the proceedings once the defendant was calm enough to do so.
When was the polycom used?
Pardon me?
When was the polycom used?
During the second day of voir dire.
Okay.
The defendant had asked on the first day to recess and to recess overnight, which request was granted by the trial court, and then they asked that he be allowed to participate via the polycom on the next day, which request was granted, and that occurred, and the defendant said he wanted to do that for that day, but that he expected to be back in court the next day, and he was. And then from that point on until
Was the judge required to have a hearing as indicated by your opposing counsel?
Well, I think that the question there is was there, the statute sort of contemplates if there's a reasonable basis to think the defendant might not be competent to stand trial. In other words, the trial cannot proceed. Then a competency evaluation should be ordered. And a hearing would be held, as counsel pointed out, if there were conflicting reports. In this case, though, defense counsel expressed concern, but then informed the trial court that Mr. Driscoll had been found competent in the most recent evaluation, and then also that there had been an earlier evaluation showing that he was not fit for trial. And then those reports were submitted to the trial court, and the trial court reviewed them. And I think a review of those reports shows that the trial court really didn't have a reasonable basis to think that the trial could not proceed, and that Mr. Driscoll was incompetent to proceed and stand trial at that point. As I stated earlier,
should he have had a hearing?
Well, I think the court essentially conducted an inquiry on the record and took evidence from defense counsel through these reports, and made its ruling based on that, which may indicate that this court wouldn't have to defer to credibility findings, for example, because there wasn't testimony on the record. But I think this court can review those reports as well as the trial court and see that it didn't really raise a question as to whether Mr. Driscoll could stand trial.
But did the statute require a hearing?
No, not under the procedure that the trial court followed, because the trial court didn't order an evaluation like the statute suggests if the trial court has reasonable cause to believe the defendant's incompetent. So the procedures under Section 552 really didn't come into play in the procedure where a hearing is required, because the court didn't go through the procedures that were set forth in 552.
I think maybe the question goes to what were there reasonable grounds to believe the defendant was incompetent, at least during the panic?
Right. I think that the only evidence that was presented was that during the discrete event of a panic attack, the defendant wouldn't be able to consult with counsel, and that was it. And, you know, the defendant's previous pleadings to the trial court had indicated, based on relying on Dr. Fusatola's report, that the defendant would be competent if the court would take breaks and allow the defendant to calm down. So, you know, the previous pleadings to the trial court had indicated, look, we think that there's a potential problem if he has a panic attack. We think it can be resolved if the court recesses and gives him time to compose himself. And the evidence that was then presented wasn't anything more than that. Dr. Gruenberg's report was essentially the same thing, that he's not going to be competent because, as she said, it is, and this was the sole basis for her apparent conclusion that he was not, that he was unfit to stand trial, because he is likely unable to appropriately conform his conduct in courtroom, rendering unable to cooperate with his attorneys. So there would be moments, temporary moments, according to Dr. Gruenberg, where he wouldn't be able to consult with his attorneys. But that was something that I think the trial court reasonably concluded could be managed through...
And was that conclusion reasonable in light of what occurred during the penalty phase?
I think so. I mean, during the penalty phase, the defendant asked to be excused. But he didn't ask for a recess at those times when he asked to be excused, when he made a peremptory request, could I be excused? If he had made, at all points where he made a reasonable request for either a recess, a break, to be excused, those requests were accommodated. Now, there were two instances during the penalty phase where the trial court did say, no, I'm not going to grant your request. But in both of those instances, the court said to counsel and Mr. Driscoll, how long do you think you need? Well, the response was, we can't, I don't know. And so the trial court essentially denied what was a request for a recess of indeterminate length. But previously, the trial court had granted a request to recess for the evening, had granted a request to recess briefly to allow Mr. Driscoll to compose himself. And if there had been a request, and for example, well, could we recess for an hour so that we could talk, he could calm down, then I think that it's probable that the trial court would have granted that request and viewed it as a reasonable request. But those sorts of requests weren't made at that point in the trial. The defendant simply asked to be excused during the presentation of some evidence. And before the state's witnesses, the trial court recessed and took the time to question Mr. Driscoll and said, all right, let's talk about it. And Mr. Driscoll said, well, I've been told about what the evidence is going to be, it's going to come out, and I don't want to be in here for it. And but there wasn't any request, any alternative request that the court allow him some time to compose himself or anything along those lines. So to suggest that the trial court was not accommodating Mr. Driscoll's requests in this case, at least insofar as he made reasonable requests, I think is not borne out by the record. And there's a lot of facts laid out in the brief, and there were many instances where Mr. Driscoll made a request to the court or asked to be excused, particularly in the penalty phase. In the guilt phase, there was very little going on along these lines. But by the end of the trial, I think that the expectation should have been, and what the trial court had done throughout the trial should have made plain to the defense, and I think did make plain, that if they made a reasonable request, and if they needed some time, or if they needed a recess to allow Mr. Driscoll to compose himself, then the court would grant those. And the supplemental report that was filed by Dr. Fusatola, the email report on the fourth day of trial, he indicated in there that medication could reasonably be expected to decondition his panic response. And then here's what I think is really important there. He said, during the panic attacks and in the moments before and after attacks, I am concerned that Mr. Driscoll does not have the capacity to assist you in his defense. Now, what he was talking about there and describing was what everybody had been talking about from the beginning. Temporary moments when Mr. Driscoll would not be able to consult with his attorney because he was too angry or too anxious. And earlier in that report, he says, the recent episode described, and he's referring back to the episode during voir dire, appears to be a panic attack, which is a discrete period of abrupt intense fear or discomfort. It's a discrete period. It's not something that extends over a long period of time. It's not a permanent state. It's a temporary state. And he described it as momentarily before and after being able to unable to consult with counsel. The bottom line here is that this trial did not, no part of this trial proceeded during a period where Mr. Driscoll was incompetent to stand trial. At all relevant phases of this trial, he was in his right mind. He was able to consult with counsel. He may have experienced discomfort, and he may have been concerned that he was going to have a panic attack. But there's no right to be tried when you're in a state of perfect equanimity. Your own personal characteristics, your own proclivities are something that, to the extent that they can be accommodated in the courtroom, Perhaps they should. But there's no right to be tried in a state of perfect equanimity. And one can, I think, rationally understand that it would be very difficult for anybody at trial to be calm, not to be anxious, and particularly in a trial of this magnitude where you're facing very serious crimes and very serious penalties. And I certainly can sympathize with that. But I think that the trial court did as well. And I think erred even on the side of caution. You know, the prosecutor wasn't entirely convinced that Mr. Driscoll's condition was as serious as it was made out to be. But the trial court treated it as if it was and took, I think, reasonable steps and took all reasonable steps and granted those reasonable requests by defense counsel. Unless the court has further specific questions about any of those points, I would refer the court for the remainder of my arguments to the brief and ask the court to affirm Mr. Driscoll's convictions and sentences.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, before you get started, were there requests made to allow the defendant to compose himself when he felt the panic attacks were coming on?
Well, in penalty phase, what had happened was defense counsel advised the court before penalty phase started that Mr. Driscoll was extremely anxious. And then during the state's opening, Mr. Driscoll had to be excused. And he had to be excused because if he weren't excused, he would have had a panic attack in front of the jury.
But were there any times where defense counsel asked for a continuance or a recess in light of the defendant's condition?
Yes, yes. In penalty phase, she did. They both did. Repeatedly asked for a continuance.
What about a recess to allow the defendant to...
Yes, and that... Defense counsel asked for a recess or an alternative, a continuance, and the court then said, well, how much time would you need? And when defense counsel said, well, I don't know. He's incredibly anxious. We don't know when he's going to be fit to go back into court. That's when the judge said, you know, we can't continue this indefinitely. We're going.
And did defense counsel then say, well, give me some set period or give me a few minutes or any follow-up request?
No, counsel did not, but counsel had no idea how much time would be needed, so I don't think it even occurred to counsel because the court had already been a recess. They asked for more time, and because they couldn't say how much more time was needed, the court said we're going.
And was there evidence before the judge at that time that defendant was in the process of having a panic attack, or was it a fear that he might have one if he heard the witnesses, or what was the state of
He still felt extremely anxious and feared that if he returned to the courtroom, he would have another panic attack.
When he was out of the courtroom and watching by television, was he in contact with counsel?
He had an investigator from the public defender's office sitting with him, and they could try to call or text counsel. They did have some problems with the communication, and of course there would be a delay. It's not like you're sitting in court where you can just immediately turn and get counsel's attention. But they attempted to communicate by text and by phone.
Was there any time during the trial, when the trial was underway, that he was not able to communicate with his lawyer?
Well, he was having these panic attacks. And to tell you the truth, Judge, we don't know. I mean, we don't know how often he was in periods of anxiety, especially in penalty phase when he was present there. When it perhaps didn't rise to the level where he was like, I've got to get out of the courtroom now. The thing about not having a hearing in this case
let's stay with this topic. Does he claim that there were times when he wanted to communicate with his counsel and he wasn't able to?
Well, not specifically, but he claimed that he, the problem was that he could not remain in the courtroom without having these panic attacks.
He also claims that he was unable even to observe by the Polycom.
Right.
The
Polycom didn't work well for him because it made him more anxious, and it made him feel like the whole situation was very unreal, observing through a television screen.
He did actually text counsel, though, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
He did actually exchange text messages, didn't he?
He did, but they had problems at times with that, where the line was dropped and whatnot.
What is it you think a hearing would have shown? Because if everybody agrees he was competent when he wasn't too anxious and that he did have panic attacks and needed to be accommodated, what would the hearing would have just fleshed out those details, but what else would it have done?
Okay. The hearing would have, he never had a chance to have the court consider testimony by an expert who had evaluated him after this hearing and discussed medication to be what medication could have worked under circumstances.
But I understand about, it's unclear why he couldn't get medication, but if the purpose of the hearing is to determine if he's competent, and from the doctor's reports they knew that he only claimed to be incompetent when he was having panic attacks, and if the judge kept him out of the courtroom when he had panic attacks, what else would as to this issue of competency, what would the hearing have accomplished?
I don't think it's as specific in Dr. Grunberg's report. She says that he's likely unable to appropriately conform his conduct in the courtroom, rendering him unable to cooperate with his attorneys and assist in his defense during trial.
So you think it would have extended to other periods of time?
In addition to possibly becoming explosive and disruptive during the trial proceedings. I think it's a broader problem where he was going to be having these problems, unable to aid and assist because he was having trouble with anxiety and conforming his behavior. I don't think it's just the anxiety attacks. And the statute requires a hearing to let us flesh this out, to let the experts testify, because Fusatola did back off of his finding of that he was competent.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The matter will be taken as submitted.